I'm Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. You're listening to This Is The Way podcast, and today I'll react and discuss the Star Wars Andor Season 1 finale. The episode's called Rick's Road. That's also the name of the main street of the town on the planet Ferrix. The big showdown at Marva's funeral is set to take place there. It's where the Empire has been making examples of people on the planet for years. Years ago, killing Cassian Andor's adoptive father, Clem. It's the place Miro wants to set an ambush, and Marva posthumously starts a revolution of sorts. We don't hear about Rick's Road in Rogue One, or A New Hope, or anywhere that I'm aware of, really. It's not just that it's a new creation for this show. This is just one of many places that is a spark of the rebellion. It's like Aldani or Narkeena 5 before it. Before Ryloth and Lothal in the years to come. And it's going to lead to places like Jedha, Scarif, and Alderaan. It's all because the Empire, through the ISB, thinks frightening subjects of the Empire into submission is the best course of action.
Fear will keep the local systems in line. Fear of this battle station.
And what of the rebellion?
What indeed, General Cassio Tag. Before I give my thoughts about the episode, the show's setting is before the events of Rogue One, and the movie has been out since 2016. Nothing that happened in the movie or the show is a spoiler. Disney and Lucasfilm have created tons of content since George Lucas sold off his intellectual property. If you're listening to this podcast, you're saying yes to the possibility of discussing anything and everything released. If there's something you've been saving that you don't want to hear anything about, please go watch that. Come back later, or accept that you might hear about it. If you are ready to talk about episode 12 of Andor, well then,
let's get to it.
The writer for the finale is the showrunner, Tony Gilroy. He wrote episodes 1, 2, and 3, and episodes 11 and 12, and it seems like I've been singing his praises for months now. There is a very insightful article posted to Collider.com with him, where he reveals the motivations behind some of the scenes, hints at what is to come, and I'm going to address some of those things throughout and at the end of this podcast, but I definitely recommend that you check out that article by Maggie Lovett. It was called an exclusive, published Sunday the 27th of November, and it's called Andor Creator Tony Gilroy on When to Expect Season 2, Time Jumps, and Meeting K2SO. There are podcasts, and more interviews, and there will be more and more in the weeks to come, because as I heard it, writers in Hollywood are looking at this show as a masterclass. Now, when writers with egos as big as California tell you something they didn't write is amazing, that tends to make me want to listen. It's not hard to find glowing praise about Gilroy and Andor in the critic community. Directing is once again Benjamin Caron, his third episode this season. As I understand it, he'll be back in season two. The production designer, Luke Hull, the guy did great work. So many practical sets used. He had a lot of work to do. And I think it really helped pay off in the final product. I'm not bashing the volume by any means. I just think the practical sets really added something that we couldn't really put our finger on, but we just sensed. The stunt coordinator is Mark Maley. He worked on a number of Harry Potter movies and Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. I appreciated his restraint. You know, not having to script moves for Jedi, he kept the fighting realistic and very believable to me. It worked very well. The composer is Nicholas Bertel. He's done some great work, but his third volume of work on the score and soundtrack was supposed to be available on December 2nd. for the last episode. I love that he used a marching band and that it tied in for 12's main title theme. And I appreciate the effort to make it sound amateur. But because of that, I don't think that that track is going to be an oft-listened-to segment of the soundtrack. The runtime for episode 12 shows up as 57 minutes in parentheses on the Disney Plus show page. The action runs a little less than 48 minutes, from the start of the Andor title screen at the open until it cuts to black on the Fondor. The post-credit scene, and yes, there is one, is short. Only about 30 seconds, but it is an exclamation point you just do not want to miss. The thumbnail description, available on the episodes tab of Andor in Disney Plus, reads, Cashin returns home to Ferrix, a tinderbox that is experiencing a spark of rebellion. The description on the page when you select the episode in Disney Plus is slightly different, reading, Targeted by numerous interests, the fugitive Cashin returns home to Ferrix, a tinderbox that is experiencing a spark of rebellion. We've reached the part of the podcast where I like to talk about the cast.
You think anybody's listening?
The title character is Cashin Andor. Diego Luna plays him here in Andor and in Rogue One. Luthen Rail may be the best new character introduced in Star Wars in a long time. I can't think of anything I didn't like about Stellan Skarsgård's performance. He's had some of the best dialogue written for him, and it has been one of the most believable parts of the journey for me. If, for example, you compare Luthen in Andor to Reva from Obi-Wan Kenobi, both are supposedly not just portrayed by actors, right? The characters themselves, Luthen and Reva, are supposed to be putting on a performance for the other characters. It's completely unbelievable to me that Reva could last as long as she did. I think that's because Moses Ingram was not just a terrible actress, but her character was as a result as well. I understand that some people like the show Obi-Wan Kenobi a lot. My opinions can be well informed, and you can still disagree. But saying Ingram gave a better performance than Skarsgård? I think that's laughable. You can still disagree, but my eyes have seen both shows. I'm old enough and seen enough TV and movies to know a good performance from a bad one. Senator Mon Mothma was played by Carolyn Blackiston in Return of the Jedi, but Genevieve O'Reilly is now my Mon. O'Reilly played her in the prequels and deleted scenes, then in Rogue One, and her work on Andor, I think, really grabbed ownership of the character. Luna, Skarsgård, and O'Reilly certainly deserve top billing, but if they make up the starting lineup, the players coming off the bench have been just as crucial to the game plan. ISB supervisor Dedra Miro is played by Denise Gao, and Cyril Karn is played by Kyle Sala. Those two share a spot on the same major cast title card at the end of the episode. I know some people are rooting for them to form a relationship, and I hope those that do think about why. I am glad, for one, that Miro and Karn did not share a kiss or an embrace. It's great art, but it's still fiction, and bound to the contemporary period that it's created in, so writing them into a relationship, you can certainly do that, but I think it's problematic. This happens in real life. I just don't want to see it happen in Star Wars. As a matter of personal preference. And maybe, you know, as a father of two girls. Okay, that could be part of it. Gao and Solar are giving great performances. They may have good chemistry on screen. I just don't want that directing the stories for the characters. It is amazing to me how those first few episodes, I was rooting for each of those characters to turn to the rebellion independently. But as the story progressed, as the actors breathed that imperial life into their characters, I had no issue rooting against them and hoping they'd actually meet unfortunate ends. Adria Arjona plays Bix Kayleen. She will be back for season two, but I feel like I saw enough of this character. I can't help but feel like Bix was just used as an emotional whip for Andor. Arjona did have to reach some low depths in her own soul to pull off that torture she suffered, so she did a great job. I just don't really care about the character that much. I mean, that's kind of harsh, but, you know, I don't think it's a fault of the actor. Maybe it's just the way the character is written. Faye Marseille played Velsartha, cousin to Mon Mothma, rook of Luthen's chessboard of rebels. I did like the fire that Marseille brought to the character, but as I said in the Daughter of Ferrix reaction and discussion episode, I think some of that comes from just my recognition of her as the waif in Game of Thrones, more so than the performance she gives in Andor. Fiona Shaw is still Harry Potter's Aunt Petunia to me, but I was pleasantly surprised at how well she fit the role of Marva Cassarrey Andor. The hollow speech she delivers was terrific. I know it was written for her, but she played really well opposite Diego Luna. I also learned in the past week that the character's final words were not "fight the Empire," but a different F word that I actually think Disney was right to change to "fight." Virata Sethu played Cinta Kaz. And look, maybe it's the way the character herself was written. Maybe it's the choices Sethu made in portrayal. I don't really feel the connection to her character. And honestly, I don't feel like the script needed her at all. Maybe if I'd seen Sethu in another tough role or something, I'd have believed her more in the series. I know that the character of Arvel Skeen said that, you know, she's the toughest of them. I don't agree. I think it's a bit more than that. I think you could have combined the characters of Cinta Kaz and Velsartha. I think you could just make them one character and it would have played just as well to me. I don't think you needed her at all. I did, however, connect with the character of Perrin Firtha. Now, maybe that's because I'm a father, but I liked Alistair McKenzie's portrayal of Mon Mothma's husband. Not necessarily the character, but the portrayal. I mean, it was important to dislike Perrin, right? But you couldn't completely hate him. I think it added something to Mon Mothma to be able to sympathize ever so slightly in the last episode. I mean, that makes his wife's scheming so much more the clever. McKenzie, I feel he walked that line well. Joplin Sebtain made a name for himself with his portrayal of Brasso. For a large guy to be so warm to a droid and comforting to a friend, now it's not totally against type, but surely that's going to earn him some looks for future projects. Anton Lesser's work on Andor as Major Partagaz has this part for him, supplanting the one of Qyburn from Game of Thrones in my mind. If I watch that show again, I'll think of Star Wars and every other thing I see him in, like 1899, I just think there's Major Partagaz. Richard Dillane was Davos Gul'dan, and I wonder if we're going to see or hear about him at all in Season 2. Leeta and his son have been introduced, right? So he did a fine job. There's nothing, though, that I feel like I need to see the character again unless he ends up plotting against Mon Mothma for the Empire. Maybe she has to kind of beat the clock. Maybe he's uncovering things or trying to make a play for some political power, and then she decides to make that speech for the Gorman people that forces her into hiding at some point. We know the speech and her escape happens because of rebels, but maybe some scheming behind the scenes is an additional factor in her outing herself and then running away. I really enjoyed Alex Ferns as Sergeant Mosk. Alex Lawther was great as Nemec, and Gary Beadle did a great job as Clem Andor. Now, Nemec might have been a bit larger character from an important standpoint, But each of the actors brought their A game to whatever work they did. Okay, now to the cast in order of appearance. We see Wilman Pak first, and it's Muhannad Bayer's biggest role so far in his young career. Korv is played by Noof Usalam, and getting a Star Wars death is a pretty cool thing for your resume. Wolf Scolding was Captain Vanis Tego. Zan Wan was Zubin Varla, and again, suffering death is a bummer for your paycheck, right? You're not going to be back in Season 2, but it's got to happen to someone sometime. And if yours happens to be a death in Star Wars, that is a cool addition to the old CV. Rashi is Victor Perez. Nurchi, back from very early in the season, is played by Raymond Adam, and the actor made him especially easy to hate. So I don't know what that says about the writing or the acting, but great job by Raymond. Chloris, indeed a spy for the Empire. The driver was played by Lee Ross. Pegla, once again played by Kieran O'Brien. Lieutenant Keysax was Nick Moss. We revisited Lieutenant Supervisor Blevin. It turns out Coruscant and political corruption is part of his beat, so we got to see the actor Ben Bailey-Smith again. Supervisors LeGret and Grandy are there again, which means Michael Jenn and Lucy Russell were back, but so is Super Spy Supervisor Lonnie Young. Still in place in the ISB. Once again, portrayed by Robert Emms. I would very much enjoy seeing a scene or two of him eventually fleeing the Empire for peace and safety, but only if that includes his family, right? We heard he has a new baby girl. B2EMO is voiced by Dave Chapman, and from a Collider.com article, I learned how big of a deal that was for the puppeteer to do the ADR work for him as well. So congratulations to Chapman, but I still think I'd have preferred to hear something else. Now, it's clear the character is a slow, old family dog. I can understand the almost cartoonishly out of place voice. And now that Chapman is the character and made that choice, he is B2EMO, so now I don't want to change. I didn't particularly like Alan Tudyk's choices for K2SO at first. But if you were some reason going to make a change with how he sounds, well, I'd be upset with that too. So as much as I didn't like it at the beginning, now Chapman is B2EMO. Neil Bell is back as the Time Grappler, and as we saw, also a Stormtrooper kicker. The recon soldiers were Liam West and Nick Preston. Chezzy was played by Pamela Nomvete. Dr. Mulmoy returned, meaning the music department's Matt Dunkley got to once again appear in front of the camera. I imagine he was pulling double duty on set, as opposed to only conducting the orchestra, because there was an actual amateur band playing music. Tennek, the cook in the hotel/imperial headquarters, was played by Gavin Spokes. He was Lord Lionel Strong in the last season, or the first season, of House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones prequel series. Leeda, Mon Mothma's daughter, is Bronte Carmichael. Stekkan Skulden was Finley Glasgow, and Stekkan is the name of the son of Davo Skulden, presumably the future son-in-law of Mon Mothma. It is the young actor's first listed role on IMDb. The wife of Davo, Runai Skulden, was Rosalind Halsted. She has a BBC career dating back to 2003 and includes the BBC series version of Sherlock with Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch and the movie Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. You know, I worked all season long to really dig into the IMDb lists of all the actors, see if I could find connections. You know, but sometimes IMDb is inaccurate. I did also use StarWarsNews.net and the collection of casting announcements I could find on Variety and The Hollywood Reporter. Sometimes I'd find interesting interview articles. I found, for example, that anyone we don't see die on screen is fair game to be brought back for season 2, according to Tony Gilroy. That includes someone we don't see in this episode, Kino Loy. The name that goes with that character, of course, is Andy Serkis.
Nobody here gives their real name.
To start episode 12, you gotta press play, and then you get the Disney Plus snap, a previously on segment, Lucasfilm Star Wars sequence, and the Andor title sequence. It sounds a bit pitchy with a solid drum beat. Not exactly a war march. Not exactly a funeral dirge. It's a little bit of both and a little of neither. It sounds like it's being played by a marching band with well-used instruments. It's a little pitchy. It's supposed to sound like amateurs getting together. It's supposed to be that because that's what we're going to see on screen later. After that final title screen of the season, we're taken to Ferrix, and Wilman Pak is soldering something. When you pair that with the post-credit scene, they're great bookends for the episode. We will gradually discover what he's making when he uses it, but by the third time we check on him, most people probably have it figured out. From the shot, we go to the Ferrix port, where a shuttle is landing at night. Dedra Miro disembarks, flanked by death troopers. First order of business, checking on the prisoner, but she wants to walk the town. She's wasting no time. A lot seems to be riding on this operation for her, and she's trying to nab Cassian Andor.
You're here. Welcome, and just in time for dinner.
I'll eat later. I want to get changed, take a walk around the town.
I'll pull an escort.
No need. Corv will take me. Keep it small.
As you wish.
We check back with Wilman. He's still soldering away, but with the scowl on his face, we can tell he's up to no good. There's also a hologram on the desk he's working at, and I think most people probably figured at this point we weren't just checking on him to see how he's holding up. This is when I figured, oh, he's making a bomb. Elsewhere in town, Brasso's getting off work, and Zanwan, the man Cassian called at the end of last episode, waits for him. Zan tells Brasso about the call, and we get a shot of Nurchi watching them, and they're just walking and talking. Nurchi's watching. Brasso tells Zan that Marv is being watched, so they know, or at least figure, that the Empire is up to something. They're not the only ones out walking, though. Corv and Dedra are trying to blend in, walk the streets. She's wearing a cloak, so Secret Jedi! I'm kidding, of course. But it's funny how few people outside Jedi or Sith wear a cloak like that. It seems to be the go-to disguise when that would be the first thing that I'd notice. Cinta is on a walk too. She's watching, following them. As I mentioned in the last episode, I believe she finally has Corv clocked for a spy. Later, she'll also mention that she recognizes Miro as ISB. So much surveillance, but they're missing something. No one gave a second thought to the kid they orphaned when Tego hung Salmon Pak on Rick's Road. Wilman is still quietly working in the shop, putting the finishing touches on his act of rebellion. The focus of surveillance is finding Cassian. Nurchi, as it turns out, is gathering information on him by providing Zan with drinks at the bar. Nurchi pretends to feel sympathy for Cassian and pretends to be sure that there's no way Cassian would come home. Zan can't help but correct Nurchi. It's apparent from Nurchi's facial expressions away from the table, he most definitely wants to know what Cassian is up to, the exact opposite of what he's telling Zanwan.
Guarantee you he's got no idea what's going on. Bank on that.
I won't be so sure.
Hey, you know something I don't? Do me a favor, keep it that way.
Nurchi was an episode 1 nobody, and that scene of him asking for his money back, now kind of has a payoff in the finale. He's a grade A traitor of Ferrix. We head back to Willman in his father's shop, and I feel like at this point there's no doubt what he's making. I mean, we know after the fact, but I think if you don't know by now, then you just haven't been watching closely. The hollow projection is indeed of his father, and for some reason, he powers on the bomb. He's either checking to make sure it works, turning it on so we see it works, or this was there to confuse people who already guessed what he was up to. Based on the soldering and the activation with the dial, this is kind of an unnecessarily high-tech bomb. I guess when you think about Star Wars tech, you know, thermal detonators and stuff, it would fit that there would be some circuitry, and maybe that's somehow creating the explosion rather than what we have in this world, which is a purely chemical or pressure-type bomb. Willman is preparing something that he's going to set off later, and I like how the next scene is Mon Mothma preparing some information she expects will detonate elsewhere. I also want to point out, she displayed this moral struggle with trying to avoid selling out her daughter, one who, by the way, clearly embraced the tradition of arranged marriage, but Mon Mothma has no problem throwing her husband Perrin under the bus. Listen, it's a smart move. I'm absolutely positive this scene was intended for Cloris to rat her out. And it could not have gone any better for her. I truly love that it was Blevin, the surface level thinker that's directing this covert op using the driver. So first, we get the revisit of the character of Blevin. But second, and obviously more importantly, we know he doesn't want to dig into the information. You know, if this got in Amira's hands, she would have been playing chess. She wouldn't have let it go. I think we can understand here that the performance by Mon Mothma worked. I also like how Perrin doesn't think Cloris is listening. It's a great detail. He's telling Mon, someone's trying to take him down to get to her, but then he doesn't think enough of that to excuse a driver listening in on their conversation. Spy or not, he just not, you know, he's like, somebody's trying to take you down by getting to me, or take me down by getting to you. And then he's just not thinking, like, well, no, he's not listening. It just shows how disconnected he really is. Great writing. I also feel like we're supposed to believe that he has been gambling. Maybe not as much as he thinks Mon is accusing him of partaking, but I definitely think he's done it here and there on Coruscant. To an addict, never means occasionally.
You can't live without a casino? Fine. You go to Canto Bight and do whatever it is you need to do. But not here. You promised.
I've kept my promise.
Keep your voice down.
He can't hear me. This is wrong, Mom. This is people trying to take you down by coming after me.
You tell me who's saying this and I'll tell you why.
Oh, please.
Where would I get the money?
That's the question that scares me the most.
Someone's lying to you.
On that we can agree.
Scenes like that are just so well written, it's hard for me not to be impressed. We go back to Ferrix, see Vel and Cinta, they're keeping an eye out at night. Vel is still disillusioned about her life, Cinta is still committed to the cause. We do learn, for sure, Cinta figures Korv for ISB and Dedra for his boss. Vel and Cinta must not be night owls, or be watching in the right place, because early in the morning, Cashin visits the stone made from the ashes of his father and remembers a moment they shared, and he's totally fine. Clem, in the flashback, tells him the man who sees everything is more blessed than cursed. The lesson Cashin learns is pay attention. Marva was kind of telling him that when they last spoke and he didn't want to listen. Now, Cashin is having this flashback that speaks to the other part of him. His mother was saying things aren't right. You just don't want to see it, or you don't want to deal with it. He's remembering now his father showing him cleaning, you know, these old mechanical parts If you don't look, you don't make this effort, you're going to lose out tenfold. Cashin lost his father and now his mother. But he also lost his sister and his home first, right? Kanari? He displayed this desire to fight when smashing things on the ship that Marva and Clem found him on all those years ago. If that fire has been asleep inside of him all this time, he's finally waking up.
People don't look down the way they should. They don't look down, they don't look past the rust. Not us, though, eh? Eyes open, possibilities everywhere. Just need to get this cleaned up before Marva finds us doing this in the house.
Waking up is something we're going to hear from Marva in a little bit. Cashin next drops in to visit Bix via his usual route to the shop, and he's greeted by the dogs of Pegla. It's a good thing it wasn't Nurchi looking after the shop, for probably many reasons. Pegla is another townsperson that tells us how much Marva was loved in the community. The script has him tell Cashin that so we can hear it. Cashin is confused, though. Why is the place being sold? Where's Bix? Pegla doesn't say where she is on screen, but we don't need to hear where Bix is because we already know. Overlaying scenes of Bix shaking in the headquarters and Luthen arriving on Ferrix in his Fondor is Cashin listening to Nemec's manifesto on the ship that brought him to Ferrix all those years ago. Cashin is finally at the point where he can accept the words. Nemec says the rebellion is formed by random acts and the group of people enlisted don't even know they're part of something bigger yet. Kind of sounds familiar. Nemec says it will grow because the Empire's authority is unnatural. That makes me recall Palpatine's poisonous words to Anakin at the opera in Revenge of the Sith. In true manifesto form, Nemec repeats a phrase, constantly telling people to remember this or remember that.
And then remember this. The Imperial need for control is so desperate because it is so unnatural. Tyranny requires constant effort. It breaks. It leaks. Authority is brittle. Oppression is the mask of fear. Remember that. And know this. The day will come when all these skirmishes and battles, these moments of defiance, will have flooded the banks of the Empire's authority, and then there will be one too many.
Nemec believed it was a building movement before he ever saw it. So, you know, he burned his life for a sunrise he never saw, as Luthen put it. Nemec is talking about one single moment that's going to change everything, and we see one single person silhouetted in the rain while he's saying that. It's Cashin. So many moments led up to Luke trusting the Force, turning off his targeting computer. So many more moments led to Luke confronting Vader in front of the Emperor, and Han and Leia destroying the deflector shield, and Lando and Wedge flying into the incomplete second Death Star. So many individuals had moments, but Nemec didn't even get to add to his manifesto after the success at Aldani.
One single thing will break the siege. Remember this. Try.
I don't know why Gilroy chose that word, try, considering it's one of the most famous phrases in Star Wars, do or do not, there is no try. Maybe he's pointing out, though, that Jedi have this duty, whereas the people Nemec is hoping to reach have to be the ones to make the effort, because the Jedi cannot do it all, and they did not make an effort, right? I mean, they failed. They're almost extinct. For Luke, the path of the Jedi requires him to succeed. For the galaxy, Nemec is perhaps saying, we don't need mystical superpowers, and if we're relying on the Jedi, we're doomed. We don't have to, though. We have each other.
We've loosened air traffic, as you requested, pulled back our uniform patrols, relaxed our curfew. We've baited the trap and opened the door. We've got recon units prepped and positioned. I know you've got your own sources out there.
Captain Teego is exactly the kind of dutiful Imperial officer we're used to having, and so are Korv and Kisax. I really feel like they fit with the original trilogy Imperials we saw. They're smart, proactive, but they're always trying to guess what their superiors want, while so often guessing wrong. They're all show-offs, or at least the ones that are successful tend to be. That kind of learned behavior gives them the illusion that what they're doing is so clever, it can't possibly fail. The trap is set, so let us sit back and watch it sprung. I think it's fantastic, though, that Miro, at the beginning of the series, seemed almost too competent to be an agent. And she has this foresight to say, maybe what others would have just assumed. You know, we can't interrogate a dead body.
Containment, yes. Snipers, no. I want him taken alive.
I want that message passed along the line. Clearly.
Now she's one of the higher-ups, though, and the town is basically a powder keg, but Miro is setting up this ambush, much like the one that's being set on Spellhouse. Before we get to that Imperial disaster of a triumph, we see it was Blevin working on the intel from Chloris. I speculated once upon a time that maybe he was a spy for Luthen. That may have been, and it was, wishful thinking at the time. Chloris reports to Blevin exactly as I believe Mon Mothma intended. Blevin is cautiously optimistic they can use Perrin's reported gambling to their advantage. You know, they want to silence Mon Mothma and all those idealistic senatorial campaigns. The ploy in the car works to perfection. Once again, the Empire thinks it's too clever to get one pulled over on it. While they're having their meeting, distant applause can be heard.
Mon Mothma is of great interest here, having her husband dig a hole for himself. Could be helpful in many ways.
It sounded like Perrin had done this before.
They've made some odd banking moves recently. This would certainly explain it.
Krieger, you're missing it.
From a certain point of view, the Spellhouse mission was a spectacular failure. A failure by Krieger, but also a failure by information standards for the ISB. Blevin joins the other ISB in the meeting room for the debriefing celebration. We can see Supervisor Lani is there, along with Partagas, and they're conferencing in Miro from Ferrix. The most telling line of the entire scene belongs to Partagas. Miro is focused on completing this mission. That's not what everyone on Coruscant cares about.
You're missing the point.
Today was about wiping the taste of Aldani from the Emperor's mouth. You want to start a conversation? Find access.
Luthen has been hanging out on the Fondor. Finally, he decides it's time for me to head into town. He puts the cloak over his head before he gets on the speeder and without a windscreen, so he must be a secret Jedi. He can keep his cloak in place on the speeder. No, but again, cloaks as disguises. Maybe it's a bit overused, but that's the Star Wars way. Also, there was some internet speculation about whether he is Force-sensitive based on his collection at the store, but I don't think he is. Meanwhile, Korv has been watching Marva's, catches on, hey, Brasso's not the one coming out with B2. So much for all this surveillance. The passages Marva might have been scouting out come back into play. That's where Cashin is hiding thanks to Pegla. Brasso comes to welcome him home and chat. A friend like him is just what Cashin needs in order to share his feelings. Brasso gives him a huge gift and tells him what Marva's final thoughts were.
But the last time I saw her, we argued. Don't. I told her I was coming back.
Stop.
I never should have left that morning.
Stop. She told me you'd say all this. Tell him none of this is his fault. It was already burning. He's just the first spark of the fire. Tell him he knows everything he needs to know and feels everything he needs to feel. When the day comes that those two pull together, he will be an unstoppable force for good. Tell him I love him more than anything he could ever do wrong.
There it is. Carte blanche from Mom. Do whatever I have to do to take down the Empire. Cashin heads off to save Bix. Brasso says he'll handle Marva's stone for the funeral. Yeah, he will. Karn and Mosk are arriving via the ferry that Luthen took into town on his first visit. You know, the one where the patron told him to mind his wallet. Cyril's looking at his hat and sulking. I think the good sergeant sees this and offers to switch to cheer him up. Whatever the reason is for the gesture, it coaxes a smile from Mosk's old boss, and they ride into town. Pegla is leaving the shop, and Nurchi notices. Cashin climbs into the roof, not onto, but into. I think we're supposed to understand that Nurchi has been watching. Cashin's friends are coming and going, and something's different about how they're acting. I think he figures he's there without having to see proof of it. Luthen approaches an unaware Vel. So much for her surveillance. He asks if Cashin is here, and she tells him, well, the Empire must believe it based on what she's been seeing. Luthen is incredibly calm. He believes the Empire is doing them a favor with this manhunt, and that somehow they're going to swoop in and kill Cashin after he's in custody.
How long do we have before the festivities start?
A few hours. You'll hear the anvil.
Lucinta.
She's watching your mother's house.
Forget that. Get up to the hotel. I'll have a look around.
That anvil is a signal. To some, it's a surprise.
What's going on? Get Cinta. I'll be at the hotel.
Others know the plan has been put into motion. The band begins to play this diegetic funeral dirge. That's when the music of the scene is not just heard by we, the audience, but by the characters in the scenes themselves as well. I read that it's an original piece and one of the first created for the show. So apparently they shot everything out of order and did everything on Ferrix first. The band sounds amateur because it was supposed to sound that way, and it was designed that way.
What's going on?
I'm not sure.
I'll bet it wasn't hard to get old high school band players to pick up instruments, whether they were actually marching and playing in the streets or on a soundstage. You know, hey Mary, you used to play French horn, right? What's it been, 10 years? You don't still play, do you? No? Perfect. The band begins to play, and the Empire scrambles to adjust their plans. I got a very Yellow Submarine movie vibe from the way the band started playing and the way they looked. I don't know. You know, the Empire thinks, hey, we've got 2 hours to plan and get ready, but the procession is starting, and people are watching now. Bix can hear it from her room. Cashin can hear it. He's watching the Empire maneuver. Two groups are converging, a yellowish, orangish kind of group, and then there's this one decked in red, and they're going to filter together and come down two different roads and meet. Captain Tigo's cape is billowing as he barks out orders. Cashin notices another caped person from his perch in the roof of the shop, and it's Luthen. So now he knows why he's there. In that moment, Cashin is putting everything together. Why else would he be there, right? He's here to kill me. Cyril and Sergeant Mosk look a little like Laurel and Hardy wandering about. The groups march on. Nurchi finds Korv in the crowd somehow and wants double his offered reward to tell them where Cashin is hiding right now. He's quite sure. But he also wants protection from the crowd and protection from Cashin. Nurchi wants a fake arrest. But what I think was going to happen anyway was, instead of a reward, they were just going to hang him as part of it or end up putting him on a factory floor somewhere, making parts for the Death Star. Like, yeah, we'll get you off world and then we'll put you on this factory floor. I think the arrest that he requests might have only been a temporary one. I think it might have ended up being permanent. Why not do that rather than pay him, right? The band plays on. Cyril and Mosk walk right past Axis. They don't even know it. Luthen stands there amused at their attempt to get past the Imperial Guard. The band plays on.
Which building?
Across the street.
I need two men.
He's seen him.
Nobody's sure he's there.
We're wasting
time. I've got a recon unit on the terrace up there.
No. I need him alive. Don't make me say it again.
Dedra needs Cashin alive. She must have him interrogated. She's got to be sure they've got Axis. I wonder, though, is that because if she fails, she's going to go down? Or does she just tell him if she fails that Krieger is Axis? We don't get to see that part. There are some great shots of our gathered crowd. We see Nerchi in custody, then Zan on the street. Woman Pack scowls at the approach of the Imperial troops that they're going to set up a roadblock. Pegla is there. Brasso is carrying Marva's stone. B2 is following, and Cashin, he's trapped in a way. Cyril sees Dedra on her way to capture Cashin with the Death Troopers. He knows she is on to Cashin. To me, it's as if we were watching a lit fuse get closer and closer to a stick of dynamite. Suddenly, the music stops. Then it starts again. A march begins. There's no drum beat here, just horns and flutes. It's not an army. It's a march of the people of Ferrix. Dedra's closing in on the hiding spot. It's a tense few moments. Is Cashin going to have to shoot his way out? Kor finds out he's not there. Where could he have gone? Marva, remember, scouted out that underground passage to the hotel. Brasso, Bix, they talked about that. Cashin uses it. He finds himself in the hotel. That is turned into Imperial headquarters. The crowd and the band are reaching a crescendo, chanting Stone and Sky.
Stone and Sky! Stone and Sky! Stone and Sky! Stone and Sky! Stone and Sky!
Cashin isn't sure what he's going to find, so he pulls his blaster. He finds the chef, and it's an old friend, Tenek. He doesn't resist. He, in fact, points him the way toward Bix. The crowd outside is primed. They're not waiting to hear a speech, though. B2 EMO projects a pre-recorded hologram that is Marva's version of a manifesto. Just like Nemix, this one has to wait for its perfect moment. Marva starts out with a short story about how she remembered coming to funerals on Ferrix since she was 6. It's poignant, gives her the chance to point out that if she was lifted up, she wants to do the same by inspiring them. Everyone is somber. She's pointing out, though, she wants them to go on. We see Luthen listening, and I thought I saw a faint smile cross his face. Nemec used remember this as his repeated phrase. Marva's phrase has to do with sleep. Not literal, figurative.
We have Ferrix. But we were sleeping. I've been sleeping. Been turning away from a truth I wanted not to face. There is a wound that won't heal at the center of the galaxy. There is a darkness reaching like rust into everything around us. We let it grow, and now it's here. It's here, and it's not visiting anymore. It wants to stay. The Empire is a disease that thrives in darkness. It is never more alive than when we sleep. It's easy for the dead to tell you to fight, And maybe it's true. Maybe fighting's useless. Perhaps it's too late. But I'll tell you this. If I could do it again, I'd wake up early and be fighting.
Captain Tego has heard enough. He tries to silence the crowd by silencing the hologram. He puts his cape to actual use, tossing it over B2, but it slips enough to only halfway cover the hologram projector. That's not a very subtle metaphor, right? The Empire slipping at covering up the atrocities. The message is still being heard. It's still getting out. The final words are, "Fight the Empire." Although we learned Tony Gilroy actually scripted a much harsher F word, and it had to be censored, and I think that's a good thing. Finding that out, though, popped this idea into my head that Dank Ferrick, you know, Ferrick sounds awfully close to Ferrix. So I wonder if Ferrick might have instead been the name of this world instead of Ferrix. Or maybe if the curse words had actually been Dank Ferrix. You know, would I have liked that surprise reveal that the curse came from this culture? I mean, I think it's only that close because, you know, the two words sound. I don't think there was any intention there whatsoever. And I guess in retrospect, even thinking that is silly. But it's only because those two words are close that it even occurred to me. So Tego comes in, overturns B2, and then a riot begins. Brasso uses the funerary stone as a weapon, something I'm sure Marva would have been very pleased to learn. The ensuing chaos sees Andor make his way up to Bix's cell. He takes out a guard, frees her. The Imperial security is starting to drag citizens on the front lines away. The anvil in the clock tower is ringing. Kesax sends a trooper to stop it. This is woman's moment. Pulls out the explosive, hurls it to all the way to the back to a patrol skiff. It explodes, starts a chain reaction with some of the charges that were there. Nerchi, watching from a headquarters window, is hurt or killed. Luthen even got knocked to the ground. Wilman, though, was spotted throwing this device. Kesax orders troopers capture him. Tego has a different order for the stormtroopers. Open fire! Brasso rescues Wilman, but stormtroopers are firing on the citizenry. Zanwan, in fact, jumps on the back of a stormtrooper but gets hit by a blaster bolt, and he is a casualty. Korv isn't in the thick of the fight. He's wandering around the edges, sees Cinta, and suddenly now he suspects her. I don't know why, now of all times. She pretends to be afraid. Lures him in, backs him into the doorway, but she is ready. Knifes him in the chest and kills him.
What are you doing here?
Pegla rescues B2 from the square and starts hauling him out. Cashin and Bix make their way to the ground floor, but a death trooper's there. Cashin, it's not a fancy scene. It's a short shootout. Just makes a diving shot and scores a direct hit to the chest. He sees Nerchi while he's on the ground inside the headquarters. And personally, I think Cashin suspects in this moment that he was there by choice. He couldn't have known that he reported on him, but I take this to mean that Cashin is not upset that he got what he deserved. Meanwhile, the stormtroopers outside have got heavy artillery working, and they're using it on the crowd. Dedra is getting jostled by the crowd, and as soon as she pulls out her pistol, she gets hit by a stone and drops it. Cashin and Bix act casual, or at least as casual as they can, as they walk out of the city center. Tego watches the tower as a stormtrooper gets kicked from the top by the time grappler, who keeps on hammering that anvil. Dedra, meanwhile, is scrambling on the ground for that pistol. People keep pulling her back, pulling her back. She's even brought to her feet. The crowd is pressing away from Rick's Road, and this is when Cyril senses his chance. He's no hero, not even in the slightest. He picks up her pistol, and while the crowd is moving, walks up behind Dedra, puts her pistol in her back, and says, "Do what I say." He forces her into a dark storeroom and closes the door behind him. This may be as close to suggesting that Mira was in danger of sexual assault as we're ever going to get in Star Wars. Or at least I hope so.
You! How?
You were in trouble. Cyril.
I knew that.
I've got to tell you, I hate this scene. The only way I could have hated it more was if they had kissed or even embraced. Everything about that scene makes me cringe. And if that's the intention, success. Bix and Cashin continue out of town. Luthen finally sees firsthand this is what real rebellion looks like. He makes his way out of town. He's not stopping to check on Vel or Cinta. He knows they're in town, but they're packing up. Cinta's still on mission. Vel, the more sensitive one here, seeing the blood she thinks is her friend's, but it's actually Korv's. Pegla and Brasso, meanwhile, they're readying a ship to get Woolman out. Jezzy's there too, but someone is approaching. It's Bix and Cashin, and it's not a cheerful reunion, just a heartfelt one. B2 is that old slow dog of the family. His master isn't coming on the ride to Ganji Moon. Instead, Cashin wants him to look after everyone. He's not going with them.
Can they make it to Ganji Moon? If they ever make it out of here?
You're not coming?
Stay low all the way to Far Side Sea. The moment you get over the water, you climb. Straight home, full pump, hand throttle, no cons. All in. You understand?
You're not coming.
Not today, B.
I never got to see you.
Take care of Bix until I get there. I'm counting on you.
You always say that.
And you always come through. Get them out of here!
He'll find us. Kazim will find us.
I will. Find you. Now go!
Luthen is speeding back to his Fondor. At first, he doesn't sense any trouble when he boards, but he begins to. Cashin is there, waiting for him. Instead of Cashin being upset with knowing that Luthen was trying to kill him, he tells him he's gonna make it easy. Luthen wonders, what kind of game is this? Who offers themselves up like that? I think he knows. This is a guy that, as he said in episode 2, Luthen did, he's going to give it all for something real.
You came here to kill me, didn't you?
It'll make it easy.
I will now.
What game is this?
No game. Kill me. Or take me in.
So, cut to the credits and show's over, right? No, there is a post-credit scene. It starts on a close-up of welding, and the camera slowly pulls back. We see the pieces that prisoners were working on in Narkina 5 are being put into place and then welded on what I initially thought was some sort of a TIE fighter assembly line. I thought those were the arrays that go on the side of the TIE fighters, but the camera pulls further and further back, and it's apparent. the focal lens of the Death Star is being constructed, the part that looks like the eye. It's where the amplification of the smaller beams are going to originate, focusing the 8 small beams of light into a planet-killing superbeam. Cassian, we learn in this moment, helps construct the very thing that's going to kill him. George Lucas is probably very proud of this moment. It's like poetry. It rhymes. All right, so what do you think?
This is the message I was sent.
Daniel of Star Wars Now This sent us another email with what he thinks. And he starts out by saying thank you for reading his first set of questions, the ones that we read in 9, 10, and 11. Obviously, thanks right back at you. I'm going to abridge some of his new comments, but I don't want to paraphrase, so let me just get to it. And while there is no question that I can find in here, I am going to reply.
The transmission we received. What is it they've sent us?
Daniel writes, one thing I appreciated in Andor was how grounded the whole show was, trying to make a space fantasy into a space reality. That isn't going to be everyone's taste, of course. But something I really appreciate about the Disney era is that there is enough content in both live action and animated form to do a bit of experimentation. The live action side of Star Wars doesn't need to be just one thing anymore than the literary side needs to be just novels or comics or blog entries, etc. He continues, back to the reality aspect. I appreciate that the showrunners portrayed the messiness of the Rix Road revolt. It wasn't well choreographed from a narrative perspective. Instead, it was dirty, messy, confusing, with people running around trying to escape, fight, find loved ones, etc. At any point, I could imagine the Imperial troops gaining the upper hand, or the residents of Ferrix storming the hotel, or any number of our characters dying. I'm guessing what we saw on Rix Road is much more akin to how revolutions actually start, in that they probably don't start as self-intended revolutions at all, just pent-up reactions to very personal injustices towards oneself, one's communities, etc. That becomes the spark that others find kinship with in their own local situations. And of course, others who have the vision or seize the opportunity, not always selflessly, to fit it into a wider narrative. Let me answer that part of it and say, yes, I think that that was the intention of the Nemec Manifesto, that people are going to find small ways to rebel and that those small ways are going to add up into a larger rebellion. And I do think that that's more realistic than just having this rebellion form while the Empire is watching, especially after how well choreographed Palpatine had the destruction of the Jedi. So yes, I think it makes a lot of sense the way they did it. Daniel has more. He says, it kind of makes me look at Luke's situation in The Last Jedi a bit differently now too. His very personal motives for challenging Vader on the Death Star 2 were about finding the good in his father and defending his sister. Those actions took place in the backdrop of the wider Galactic Civil War, and the two got conflated to the point where he became, and accepted, the role as the savior of the galaxy. Something that a desert farm boy from a backwater planet who dreamed of a life of adventure and excitement hadn't really signed up for after all. He had the unexpected burden of becoming the galaxy's hero, and the doubt of not always living up to that image. Finally, coming to terms with what his friends, his loved ones, needed of him one last time, like a certain boy from Ferrix is choosing to do, one might say. But that's a story for another time. I just appreciate that the final battle we got wasn't too clean or too choreographed. It reflected the messy, unsure of itself struggle that was a hallmark of the rest of the Andor series. Thank you, Daniel, for your thoughts. I agree that the battle was not overdone. I think that we got exactly what we needed from that riot. It wasn't a total massacre, and it also wasn't a total success. I would answer, though, that I disagree with the characterization of Luke's motivations, and I don't think that The Last Jedi realistically portrays the path Luke might have taken at all. That's an opinion I know is shared by what I believe is the majority of original trilogy fans. However, that doesn't mean that it is the right opinion, nor does it mean your own idea about his motivations are wrong. I just don't think Luke ever thought of himself as a hero or a savior, and the truth seems to be more that he was almost a secret, at least if we're to believe the action figure retelling of Krayt on Canto Bight by the stable people. I like to point out that makes absolutely no sense, though. Again, so those that fled thanks to Rey's help found it impossible to get help from the rest of the galaxy. So who heard about this? They didn't tell anyone what happened outside because they didn't see it either. And the First Order certainly wouldn't have been telling stable boys and girls on Canto Bight what happened either. Never mind that. I still think that from the characterizations that we've had in the novels, Aftermath, and so forth, that Luke wasn't seen as this big savior, and he never willingly took on that role either. I think in Andor, Cassian's sacrifice is one that he feels like he owes from much farther back in his life. He may have seen his parents die, we don't really know that. He certainly saw the crew of the wreckage kill a friend of his, and then he was basically kidnapped off of a doomed planet, and his sister was lost. The guilt he carries is much more than even survivor's guilt. But both his adoptive mom and dad set examples for him in their deaths and by their deaths that taught him, and they probably taught him as often as they could, that doing what was right was more important than mere survival. I'm not disagreeing with you to be difficult, Daniel. I'm just freely admitting, though, I'm the guy who personally removes episodes 8 and 9 from my own Star Wars headcanon. And that's after I excitedly awaited those films and then had to deal with what I saw on screen.
I've got a bad feeling about it.
Hey.
Quiet. Whoa.
Again, thank you very much for writing in, and I really do appreciate all the engagement you've given us. I did like this episode of Andor. I mentioned a fear last podcast that it's going to leave too many plot lines unaddressed. Depending on your point of view, that may or may not have come to pass. The main thread of the story is resolved in that Cassian Andor has joined the rebellion. We saw him radicalized, and we cheered on that radicalization. I mentioned in the episode 11 reaction and discussion podcast some of the things we were reminded of by the writers throughout the season. So we had a funeral for Marva. B2 is going with Brasso and Bix and Jezzy to the Ganji Moon, so that takes care of what happens to both of them. We did not find out anything new about Cassian's sister. We do not know for sure if Miro gets a promotion, a demotion. We do see her granted the protection of Death Troopers by episode 12. That's a show of power and respect for officers. The caveat there is Ferrix is a failure on her watch, so she may have just earned herself a demotion. We don't see that. Cyril does not exact any revenge on Cassian, nor does he die. He does protect Dedra, so maybe that was an alteration of his initial goals. We do not see Luthen get caught. I do think he dies by the end of the series, but he's still alive. We hear Anto Krieger's mission is an abject failure. We don't hear about Saw, but we know he survives. We do not hear more about Narkeena 5 either on the Imperial side or from Cassian to his friends. We, again, don't check back with Saw. We don't see what happened to Segra Milo. Sintakilf's Korv, so he's gone. She and Vel do not appear to be casualties of the riot. I think we are supposed to understand they escaped. Mon Mothma does in fact introduce her daughter to Davos Golden's son. And Cassian does not meet anyone new to the show yet familiar to us from other Star Wars properties. As far as setup goes, I can refer to the Collider.com article to tell you right from the showrunner himself what is planned for Season 2 and beyond. First and foremost, they've started shooting Season 2 already. It seems that Cyril Karn is the subject of the first day's shooting, so we're going to see more from him. They're going to be shooting until August of next year. That means it's extremely unlikely that we're going to see it in Season 2 before 2024. Maybe it might be even later. Why? Gilroy explained Rogue One's post-production was sped up by a ton of money being thrown at the computer graphic companies finishing that movie. He says the only thing limiting the show in that case is how badly Disney wants it for their winter 2023 slate. They don't have all 12 scripts locked, according to Gilroy. They do know the frame of the season, and there will be a one-year gap between episode 12 of season 1 and the first episode of season 2. That doesn't necessarily mean we're going to skip over anything important. On the search for Cassian's sister, Gilroy says it's to be determined. He doesn't want to close a door on it, so I'd say he's leaving it open because it's not designed to be answered in season 2, but maybe it comes into play in the script when they do finalize them. Gilroy does mention that he had the final scene planned at a very early stage, and that goes along with how he has the frame for season 2 before he hands assignments to the writers. He likens it to a puzzle where you start from the edges and work inward. There were some story bits I saw from the showrunner as well, which might not be canon, but are interesting to someone like me anyway. He supposes that Luthen and Saw have been working together for around 6 years already, but that's a general ballpark. It's not recent to the show Andor, which is 5 years before the first Death Star becomes fully operational. At this point, he says, with the 1 year gap between the final moment of season one and the first episode of season two, no one dies off screen. As Gilroy is quoted saying, everyone who lives that we care about has got to come back, and also, I'm not going to promise how long they live when they get to the other side. He specifically mentioned Andy Serkis and the character of Kino Loy and said he didn't die, so if they're not dead, they're still in the mix. About the Jedi and lightsabers being myth at this point, Gilroy mentions he didn't know or have a plan, but that because of the size of the galaxy, Jedi might be heard of, but perhaps no one has ever seen one on the planet. He also knew early on B2 was going to be the one to project a hologram of Marva for the funeral, and that Melshi wasn't destined to continue immediately with Andor after the prison break. Gilroy addressed why the prison factory only employed humans. His reasoning was quite sound. The factory was designed for efficiency, so while there were only male humans working on those parts, he said maybe there were other factories using other aliens, and those facilities would have been designed specifically around utilizing the workforce, so a new worker could just be added at any place on the line, and you wouldn't have to worry about how many hands they have, how they go to the bathroom, what they eat, any of that stuff. It was just all men, all humans, and you know, one dies, you put another one in his place, an able-bodied human in his place. It makes a tremendous amount of sense and shows you that it wasn't just, oh, let's just use human beings here. It was well thought out. He addressed the KX unit in the room and plainly said the meeting of Cassian and K2SO will have to be addressed since they're walking right into Rogue One. We may hear more of Nemec's manifesto. Tony Gilroy says the prison break was the moment of Cassian's transformation. He says we're supposed to be uncomfortable with the way Cyril and Dedra are left, likening them to fascinating neighbors across the hall or the ultimate Tinder date, ew. He says he's not saving story beats for other media. That just reinforces the hierarchy of canon for me. He is not considering maybe we save this for the comics or another show or nothing below him on the line matters. He is just trying to put out the greatest show that he can make. He even pointed out he saw the Rogue One novelization in an airport a few months after the movie and that he was surprised that people were working on it. I think of it almost like the Empire, that no one above you gives any kind of thought to the plight of the ones below. Even novelizations of his own movie are too far down the list for him to pay attention to. The article that I read mentioned B2EMO and Dave Chapman kind of falling into the voicing of the character since he was doing so much of the puppetry and dialogue on set. It was also interesting, though, to hear the process of how the aliens and droid concepts are left mostly to the props and concept artists, and then the showrunner and the people involved pick from those ideas. So you start with a design outline of a droid that's an old family dog, and then you end up with the salvage droid, B2EMO. Very interesting to me how much trust is there. You know, I mean, you just let them do their job, right? It was almost the same kind of thing with the space battle between the Fondor and the Arrestor Cruiser that was a favorite in episode 11, but the commercial side really comes through. Gilroy pointed at those action scenes as being costly, but quote, easier to get money for than something else because it has IP in it and it helps sell the Fondor, Hallcraft, and the rest of it. It really does show you the Star Wars part of it is designed to sell the toys to help make the money. He does point out it's a sense of pride for the designers and VFX departments that drives the creation of those moments. But story-wise, they weren't necessary. Gilroy saying, again, quote, it's almost like a side project. For that Fondor versus Cantwell class arrestor scene in particular, he said he sketched it up like a drive-by traffic stop because he had a place, you know, where they could do this. It wasn't designed as a plot point to move the plot along. But the community of visual effects artists working on that scene know, hey, we can do this. And so they want to prove to people watching that they can do it. It was just great insight from the showrunner to show us, like, sometimes you just got to flex a little bit and show people, you know, hey, we're good at what we do. And it made the whole thing better. It was my favorite scene, maybe, of the whole show. As the interview progresses, as laid out in the article by Maggie Lovett, I was struck by how Tony Gilroy did not seem like a huge Star Wars fan. What he did seem like, though, was a very thoughtful writer who was willing to color between the lines that he was given. Now, sometimes that doesn't work well. Sometimes, like in this case, you get a masterful work because the guy accepts that, and then he includes details of the world that he's writing for in such a great way. This show could have been messy, and I think that shows me that Deborah Chow was just not ready for Obi-Wan Kenobi. She may be now, but she clearly wasn't ready for Obi-Wan Kenobi. And I'm not sure Robert Rodriguez was ready for The Book of Boba Fett. It shows me Jon Favreau was ready with The Mandalorian and that he directed the flow of work well and he incorporated Dave Filoni in the right places. You don't have to like them. But Gilroy seems to be much more the master of that process, and honestly, if someone's replacing Kathleen Kennedy, I think rather than even Dave Filoni, you make it somebody like Tony Gilroy. Give him the reins at Lucasfilm. At least he knows how to write. Disagree? Let me know. Please send feedback or congratulations on another season of Star Wars finished to thisistheway@gmail.com. You can find This Is The Way Podcast on Twitter and Instagram @ThisIsTheWayPod. or on facebook.com/thisistheway pod. Our link tree has all the links at linktr.ee/thisistheway pod. And please subscribe, leave a positive review no matter what podcast distributor you use. I think it'll help. And thank you for joining me for This Is The Way Podcast's reaction and discussion of Rick's Road, episode 12, and the finale of the first season of Andor. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo, and this is the way. May the Force be with you always.